Star jump sequence terminates, Captain.
Get the gravitational dampers online and open the blast shield.
Aye, sir.
Bring us in closer.
Aye, aye, sir. Moving us in on sublight drive.
Extreme magnification.
Aye, sir.
The center of the galaxy. And there's our black hole.
The experience of a lifetime, Captain.
Let me put this on audio. You should be able to hear the magnetic resonance.
This is it, ladies and gentlemen. The edge of time and space, where the impossible can happen. Welcome to the event horizon.
Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whatever is relevant for the part of the world you are in. Indeed, welcome to the Event Horizon, where the impossible happens. Join us each week at this time as we delve into the worlds of science fiction, fantasy, and science fact in all their forms. I'm your host, Gene Turnbow.
And I am your other host, Susan Fox.
And with us is Brandon Roberts, and we're very excited to have you on the show today because you are the composer for Andor.
Season 2, which is really where the story is picked up.
Yeah, well, the show started... Yeah. Well, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we don't often get to talk to composers. I think we've had maybe three or four on the show since we started the show 10 years ago. And so when we do get... a composer, especially a well-placed one such as yourself, it's a real treat.
Well, I will try to do justice to it, but thank you.
Justice League is kind of the only thing he hasn't done. I've been looking over his resume. It's not just Andor. It's Logan. It's Underwater. It's let me flip. Fear Street, Without Remorse, A Quiet Place. You think that A Quiet Place would be quiet, but not so much.
Yeah, not so much.
Free Solo, which is not a Star Wars film.
That's right. That was a good pun. That was a good Star Wars pun.
Yuck, 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 yuck.
So how did you begin your journey to be a composer in the first place? Let's start there.
Oh, wow. Okay. You're going way back. Let's do it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. This is about you, not the show. I mean, not Andor. We want to talk to you.
Well, originally I was a jazz guitarist, and I have the world's most, I don't want to call it a useless degree, but I have a degree in studio jazz guitar. About that time I was doing a lot of, when I was in school, I was doing a lot of gigging and a lot of playing out in clubs and coffee shops and et cetera. And I had this revelation one night where in the tip jar, which was the only source of income, there was no, like, you basically played for free and
which
then
is,
your tip which jar.
Is, that takes courage.
Yeah. And so one night after like 3 hours or something of playing and hauling all the gear out there, I had in the tip jar no money, but just someone had left a joint. And that was it. And I had this revelation, I think, that night that this might not be a fiscally viable career. And so I very shortly afterwards, I'd always been into film music, obviously, I mean, for my whole life. But it was the first time I really thought, well, maybe I could actually do that as a career. And so fortunately, I was at USC and I segued into the film composing department there, which is you know, wonderful for anyone pursuing it. And yeah, that was kind of how I got my segue into film composing. I was probably the worst person in the class. Everybody else was so talented. It was a very, very good motivator. And then after school, I just started working for other composers. You know, I scored every short film I could. I did all the things that probably most young composers try. I sent out demos, like physical CDs, right? You know, I had
right.
CDs, mm-hmm. silk
yeah,
screen.
Because back in those days, internet, not a thing.
Exactly. And so I would go out and mail every week. I'd get the, what was it? The I always forget the trades, but what the name of the trades were, Backstage West and all those, and I would go through and find what was in production.
Variety and Hollywood Reporter.
Exactly.
I used to read the trades myself because in those days I was a practical effects guy, and that's how I would get my jobs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we all had the same, basically all doing the exact same thing, but just for different departments. I'd send the demos out and then the demo CDs. And then I would say for every, I don't know, 80 I sent out, I'd get one response or, you know, five responses. And for each of those five responses, I might get a gig. So that was kind of how I started. And then I had the good fortune of doing some orchestration and additional music for Bear Mercury on Battlestar Galactica. And then segued quickly over to Marco Beltrami when he was doing Scream 4 and this TV show V. And then I just started writing for him. And it was wonderful. I basically he was like my mentor, I guess is a good way of putting it. And we still work together. And anytime he calls, I'm like, yep, the answer is always yes. He's nicest guy in the world, amazing composer. And then I think as with most composers, you start to get projects, you know, you work for someone higher up in the totem pole, but then you start to get your own projects and slowly you whittle your way past the barriers into more relationships and start getting some gigs.
Your music, and I've taken the time to listen to a lot of the stuff that you've done for Andor, your music appears strongly influenced by Bear McCreary. So that kind of tracks.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if it is, it's not overt, or it's not intentional, I should say. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'll take it as a compliment.
Well, this is very much, you know, Star Wars for grown-ups as a show, but I was struck by how understated the soundtrack was as opposed to, you know, Star Wars in 1977 and every scene had, you know, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And there's half the show is silent except for, you know, the sound effects or conversations.
I think it's actually very true, and a lot of that is a conscious decision by Tony Gilroy, the creator of the show, and that was even set up in season one with Nicholas Britell, and I think they went out of their way to try to make it distinctive from the original vibe of the original trilogy music wise, I'm of the opinion no one can do John Williams, right?
Right.
We all try, but on our best day ever, we can't even come close to his worst day he's ever had in his life.
Yeah, Michael Giacchino, maybe he can pull it off sometimes.
Yeah, I mean he can get close, but in my opinion, you know, John Williams a deity at this point.
Yeah, because Giacchino wasn't writing themes; he was using and repackaging a lot of the John Williams.
That's true. He was. That's a good point.
Well, okay, not exactly. Because for Rogue One, most of it was, very little of it used the original themes. He quotes a little bit here and there, but the vast majority of it was actually original.
I guess those made an impression.
Yeah, he does. He definitely, like, for when Darth Vader comes in Rogue One, he definitely quotes it and moments at the end. But the vast majority of it's his. But going back to your observation about the Andor music being distinctive, that was actually one of the biggest challenges because the palette for Andor is so different than the palette for Rogue One because the palette for Rogue One is supposed to segue right into A New Hope. So it's very John Williams, very orchestral in nature.
Right. It has to key straight in.
Exactly.
I mean, it's got a mesh right up to it because it's literally a butt splice.
Yeah, but the end of this story goes straight into Rogue One, though, and that's if you were just watching it, you know, coming from nothing, from watching Andor and Rogue One and then A New Hope, that's going to be cognitive dissonance all over the map.
Yeah, and we really tried to make the handoff seem organic musically. Mm-hmm. So if a lot of the earlier episodes in Andor have a big mixture of orchestra and synth and synthesized mm-hmm. elements mm-hmm. or electronic elements. And at a certain point, we start stripping those out towards the later episodes to try to help that segue. So the segue yeah. feels more organic.
That's very clever. Yeah, that does make sense.
Yeah, it worked from the standpoint of just changing the palette made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it felt like, wow, we actually might be able to do a sleight of hand that feels organic.
Because I noticed in the first season, a lot of the background music by Nicholas Bertel was, you know, kind of like tinkly, moody, noisy stuff, you know, and not so much orchestration
almost sound effects.
Yeah, nearly sound effects. It's sort of an alliteration of music rather than something that you can point to and say, ah, here's something with a full orchestration and a solid melody line and all of this. He didn't have any of that because he's just sort of painting a mood with sound.
Well, no, he definitely had thematic material, and then, but I do think there was an industrial element to the mm-hmm. score. Like I almost hear it as I think there's, for example, a lot of the first season takes place on that planet Ferrix, and it is yes. industrial mm-hmm. in nature. So I think mm-hmm. he carried some of that over into the score really well. And then, but there were some strong themes, and definitely he's like known for his amazing string writing, and that's in there.
Yeah.
But definitely moving into season two, there was some changes. Like, you know, like Star Wars is so dictated by the locations mm-hmm. and the planets and the scenarios that the music changes very quickly based on what planet you're at. So the vibe of it or the palette.
Well, and where you are. When the scenes where he's Cassian is getting a hold of that
The TIE fighter?
Yeah, the TIE fighter. And the group of dissidents who are trying to... One is trying to aim the TIE fighter at the other group, and they're just using block and tackle because they don't know how it yeah. works and all of this. And the music that went with that kind of underscored the sort of tribal nature of what they were doing. As
no,
contracted
exactly.
to the technical, and I appreciated that treatment of it.
No, that's a good observation. We tried to lean into the fact that none of them were the sharpest tools in the shed, so we used a lot of just literally banging on metals and uh-huh. and found objects and weird percussion. So it was we definitely leaned into that concept and then coupled it with the fact that it's a jungle. So it was fun.
And then the contrast between that and the sophisticated people at the wedding was very striking.
Was it weird writing diegetic music for
the scenes that where they actually had music in the room, like the, you know, string quartet or whatever it was for the formal dance and the disco.
And the disco ball thing. That was...
Yeah. They've sure come a long way since, you know, R2-D2 with speakers on Jabba's yacht, haven't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny that, like, the diegetic music in Star Wars is like an entire career in itself, it feels like, because... Mm.
Well, it's been there from the beginning with
The Cantina Band.
The Cantina Band. Thank you.
Yes. No. Exactly. And it's so essential to the world building and the immersion that. But I don't think I ever, as well as I know the original scores and the prequel scores, I think I never truly internalized just how much source music and diegetic music there is, but especially in this season, because like you said, there's weddings, there's wedding receptions, there's wedding dances, but then you have Coruscant and you have mm-hmm. galas, like art galas going on. You have Gorman, which has tons of source music and, you know, coffee shop bands playing off in the side. And then on top of that, you're cutting in two different episodes, you're cutting back and forth between source music and score, and they need to feel like they run into each other naturally. And so that was its own challenge. But the source music was a colossal undertaking in terms of not just the quantity of it, but also basically drawing from every tool in the arsenal to make it happen.
Well, and it also had to reflect the society and culture of whatever scene was being portrayed, you know, the particular people and the ancient culture, you know, like going back thousands of years on Andor, like 12,000, they brought in this artifact, an art artifact from that had a 25,000 year history.
Oh, for the wedding.
Yeah. So that was just, that just implies that everything about their society was so baked in and so ritualized that it was almost so rigid that they couldn't even enjoy themselves.
Yeah, but it's interesting you mention that, because I don't know if you remember the hair braid cut.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember that.
But I thought it was interesting because for as posh and highbrow as that wedding is, there's a ritualistic element to all of it that's present throughout. So I tried to juxtapose the two vibes. Like I had you had tribal drums and medicine drums and these like weird tin bells that were out of tune, but at the same, and along with strings. Mm-hmm. So you get kind of the classical element with the strings, but then you get this tribal element, and the idea
jingle, and they applaud or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's no joke. Those the diegetic music in Star Wars is it really is a massive undertaking and a lot of fun.
A serious project all by itself. It's like trying to solve a jigsaw puzzle.
Totally, totally. And like you said, every single one of them is so different and serves a different purpose, right? So, but it was very fun.
Did you play any music in this?
I did. I played pretty much everything I can play. I played nylon string guitar. I played electric guitar, distorted electric bass on some of the stuff. I used Ron Rocco for certain things. Cello. Like, I don't play cello, but I can make a cello sound horrific, which was very useful sometimes. And then I played bow dulcimer. That was me just adding small amounts of things to what basically all the London musicians did, and what they did was actually played the music the right way. So,
what is, for our listeners, what is a Ron Rocco?
Oh, it's like a small a South American instrument that I wish I had it in front of me right now, but it has, I think it's four courses. Mm-hmm. And it's like a cross between a almost like a mandolin and a what's the other
instrument? Sounds like a ukulele. The four.
Yes, courses. No, that's it. It's like a cross between a mandolin and a ukulele, and it just has this very unique sound.
Want one.
What's the tuning on it?
No idea.
You remember? You don't.
No idea. I look it up. I have to look it up online every time I tune it. I tune it, and then I don't even worry about, like, I play guitar, obviously, so I don't. Uh-huh. But I don't worry about. I just find something that sounds good and play it, but I can't play it for real.
Yeah, it's for the listeners, a ukulele plays about like a guitar, except the bottom string is an octave up. So instead of the D string, it's like a D octave up, and then the whole thing is shifted. What is it, three steps? Something like that?
I don't know. A fourth.
A fourth step. It's a fourth up from a normal E.
Yeah. So I think with Ron Rocco, it's even got a few different standard tunings,
depending on,
like, I think you have some options, if I remember correctly. But don't quote me on this. I could be wrong.
Like a guitar, you know, they're used standard EAD, GBE. That's the standard tuning, but there's also, like, half a dozen others, like a drop D and open D and all
correct.
Of that.
Yeah.
So that's fun.
It was cool.
So, paint a picture for us. What's a day in the scoring studio like?
Oh, okay. Do you mean the actual recording or the writing?
Well, let's start with the writing.
Okay. So the writing is, I wake up, I get scared, because I look at the
because
scene, right?
You oh my God, I'm working on Star Wars.
Exactly. Starting with that. And I think, I mean, every film composer has the same thing, which is the blank page syndrome, where you're like, you're looking at a scene with no music, and you're like, by the end of the day, you have to have made, you know, at least some progress on it. So, Tony Gilroy and the music editor, John Finkley, and John Gilroy, the picture editor, we will have talked over the music at length, what type of vibe, and sometimes there's a temp score, most of the time there's a temp score to kind of reflects kind of the in and out points and maybe the general vibe, but mm-hmm. You know, I look at that for reference and then basically mute it and then start writing. And what I would do is I would do like three episodes, compose three episodes. Tony Gilroy would fly in, and for 3 days we'd go over every cue and get it to where we wanted. He would basically approve everything, and then everything would go off to orchestration. We'd record those three episodes in London. And then we'd repeat that process for four times. And so the main thing was I had to lay enough train tracks in front of the train, right? To keep, you know. So I tend to keep a pretty reasonable schedule, like the days of all-nighters or no, I'm not cool with that anymore. I'm just too old. Like I did that in my 20s. I'm done. But even though the schedule was tight, it wasn't unreasonable. And so everything went surprisingly smooth. And then you get the and Tony Gilroy is a wonderful musician in mm-hmm. his own right. So when he would be out here, it was like a band where like we would try stuff and, oh, that's a cool idea, let's try this. Or we might mute something, like to your point about less music. Sometimes mm-hmm. it was about taking music out of a scene or stripping something back. And the end result is, I think when he left, we both kind of felt like, okay, we know exactly where the music's going to be. Let's get this out to the musicians and make it come alive. And then London musicians, I cannot sing their praises enough. Then we'd have about 5 or 6 days of recording. So that was the process over about nine or 10 months.
So did you get like notes from the director and like... And have to scrap whole sequences, or did he just trust you to know what you were doing?
No, you always get notes, but very few times did he just say, no, this isn't the right direction. Most of the time it was, you know, occasionally there'll be a scene, right? You know, that I call it like a nemesis scene that, mm-hmm. you know, you just, for whatever reason, you're not cracking it for them. But the vast majority of stuff went very smoothly and the notes were minimal. But then, like I said, having him here was great because we got to really work on the stuff and make a lot of the tweaks right on the spot, which was nice.
So that's the composing process. And did you go to London for the performances? And
For the fourth set of recording sessions, I did. But the initial three blocks... I didn't because we'd do the recording session and then I'd have to write at night so that you'd lose,
right,
I'd lose 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, so the process was we would record for about 6 days. So we had, 3 days of recording string section, and this was all done at British Grove Studios in London. Mm-hmm. And, so we do like 3 days of recording a pretty big string section, then full brass for another day. We would do, 2 days of percussion with like four percussionists. And then we had a dulcimer, cymbalum player. Cymbalum's like this Hungarian instrument we play with mallets. It's so cool. And then we had one of the blocks, we had female choir and two soprano soloists. Another one of the blocks, we had, you know, big woodwind section. Well, actually a medium woodwind section, I should say. And then it was a race to get it all mixed in time for the dub, for when they would be dubbing all the sound and music together.
It sounds like it's as complex a job to produce the music track as it is to produce some of the visual effects. It is.
Yeah.
It is. That is, that what you've just described sounds like an incredible technical dance, and everything has to be tracked and everything has to be coordinated with great precision and with a great deal of communication going back and forth between each department to make sure that nobody drops a stitch.
Yes, 100%. But that's why you work with, it's why you wind up working with the same people a lot. Like the music contractor, they get the best, you know, they're going to get the best musicians. Mm-hmm. The orchestrator and conductor, Matt Dunkley, you know, you just, everyone's got everyone's back. Everyone knows what to do. So you put together a tight team and you're good because of the very reason you just mentioned, which is there's a thousand things to do and a thousand ways it could go wrong if anyone drops the ball, and no one drops the ball in this case. So, but it's an unbelievable logistical. Having recording sessions, especially with a large orchestra, is a logistical feat in itself that requires a massive team. Just to get the music in front of the players.
Did you have any scenes that you think were your favorites to work on?
Oh, well, the 8-year-old in me, I mean, getting to ride a TIE fighter chase. I mean, come on. I mean, that's, come on. I sort of thought
that might be one of the choices.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I looked at that and all right, here we go. You know, I mean, that was just a dream come true. And getting able to write themes for some of the planets, like Yavin, mm-hmm. And for Mina Rao, all of these, whenever I get to actually write a big theme that gets highlighted, those are always my favorite. I mean, it's, I think probably most composers would say the same, you know, I like the moments where the music's played loud. So, in terms of episodes, I thought the Gorman episode 8 was, I mean, that was almost a movie in itself. It was so ginormous. So that was probably my favorite episode to write on.
So what projects are you working on now? What's coming up next?
I totally coincidentally just had a film called Clown in a Cornfield, which is a slasher that just came out last week in the theaters. And you could not have a more polar opposite project than Andor.
No, you sure can't.
But that was a lot of fun. Very self-aware, very fun. And then I have a post-apocalyptic Western called Forgive Us All that's going to come out in theaters in the States in July. And that was a lot of fun. Like I had talked to my agent for years. I was like, please, I would love a Western, if there's any way to get a Western. And finally he says, I have good news for you. And this was a blast. So that was very fun.
And I think every guitar player wants to do a Western.
Exactly. And I'm such a, you know, such a Ennio Morricone fan and such a huge lover of Sergio Leone films. It was, mm-hmm. you
oh,
know,
yeah.
So it's kind of a,
you that iconic whistle, you know.
Exactly.
Dirty Dozen and
wah, wah, wah.
Yeah, that's, you say that, you hear those six notes and you are immediately transported, and we are immediately in spaghetti Western land.
Oh yeah. Yep.
So let's see, that's coming out
July.
That's going to be something to look forward to.
That's going to be
a post-apocalyptic Western. So you got to not only do the Western, but you got to do some flavor mixing as well.
Yeah, and it's all shot in New Zealand, so there's also that New Zealand aspect to it.
Kiwi Western.
Exactly, a Kiwi. Let's see, a post-apocalyptic Kiwi Western. Yeah, you're right. That's exactly
that
what it is.
Fantastic.
I didn't know they had like deserts and things in New Zealand. You know, you see all this stuff shot in New Zealand, and it's lush forests or rivers.
Yeah, you think Lord of the Rings or whatever.
Yeah, but they have. I mean, they have everything.
It's like, a whole country, I've been there. You know?
Yeah, they have every possible. I mean, that's why it's the ultimate film set. They have every single, they have deserts, they have waterfalls, they have, you know, anything, mountains, sure, no problem. You need volcanic areas, no problem. They have every single topographic feature that you could have.
In a very compact geological area.
Exactly.
Geographical area.
That too.
That's awesome. So do you see any more Star Wars in your future once you're done with Andor?
Okay, your question is a good one because
could he tell us if he did?
Well, no, that's exactly right. I have no idea. They're so Lucasfilm is so secretive about Star Wars projects in particular. I'm sure it's the same maybe with Marvel, but they're so secretive about Star Wars projects that I couldn't even when I got on the project, I couldn't even tell my kids what I was working on until basically right before the premiere.
Wow.
So every day I would tell my kids, I'm like, all right, Daddy's going out to go work on his miscellaneous project. And so if there are any Star Wars projects in my future, I'll be the last to know. I hope so. I had a great time doing it.
Well, the fact that you've done Andor is a huge, that's a huge plus. They're likely to call you back for the next one.
Well, I'll take it. I'll take the call and I'll take the gig.
Well, you didn't.
Yeah, and when this becomes a democracy, we'll be the first to know.
Well, that would be if it were up to me.
Yes, dear.
It would be a slam dunk. Thank you so much for joining us on this week's episode of The Event Horizon. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure, and I really appreciate it.
You have been listening to episode 285 of Sci-Fi.Radio's production of The Event Horizon for May the 24th, 2025. Our guest this evening has been Brandon Roberts, composer of the soundtrack for season 2 of the wildly popular Star Wars Andor, which leads directly to the events of the motion picture Star Wars Rogue One. The show will air again tomorrow, May the 25th at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, and again on the upcoming Thursday and Saturday mornings at 4 a.m. Pacific, 7 a.m. Eastern. After all of the air times have passed, you will find this episode and others on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbay FM, Pandora, Stitcher, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and on our own website at sci-fi.radio. If you enjoyed the programming you have just heard, please consider visiting patreon.com/sci-fi-radio and becoming a patron of the station. We are listener-supported sci-fi and fantasy fandom radio, and your contributions go to paying our DJs, our production staff, the writers for our Geek News website, our business operation fees, our music licensing, and a lot more. We have been broadcasting continuously since 2009, and we are grateful for the support of listeners just like you. That URL is, again, patreon.com/sci-fi-radio. This episode is copyright 2025 by Krypton Media Group, Incorporated. The Event Horizon on sci-fi.radio. It's sci-fi for your Wi-Fi.